Introduction to Talking Books. On behalf of the Division for the Blind and Physically Handicapped of the Library of Congress, I want to welcome you into the Talking Book program. If this is your first experience with a talking book record, I feel confident that you will find relaxation, entertainment, and information in books and magazines covering most subjects of general interest. For those of you who are already acquainted with talking books, I hope by adding to your knowledge of the program to enable you to gain greater satisfaction from this record player, the records you will receive from now on, and the regional library that will be serving you personally. Perhaps I should start with the voices that will be reading the books and magazines to you. Let me introduce a few and tell you a bit about them. First, myself, Alexander Scorby. I was born in Brooklyn, New York, of Greek immigrant parents. In high school, I was one of the school magazine editors and a co-editor of the yearbook. I went to West Virginia University intending to study journalism, but I'd already begun to act in high school, and in my one semester at West Virginia, I was active with the Dramatic Society there. I left the university on the death of my father, and returning to New York, I was accepted as an apprentice at Eva Ligalian Civic Repertory Theater. It was there that I had my first taste of the professional theater, walking on in the theater's productions and studying in the apprentice classes. My first Broadway part was the player King in Leslie Howard's production of Hamlet in 1936. Since then, I've worked in the theater, in radio, television, and films. But of late years, I've been active for the most part in the field of radio and television narration, and chiefly as announcer in numerous commercials. It has been, however, in the recording of talking books for the blind and physically handicapped that I've found my greatest satisfaction. I've been recording talking books almost from the start of the program, my first one in 1937. In the intervening 30 years, I've recorded about 300 books. I think I can safely say that almost every other actor reading the talking books feels, if not quite to the same degree, to some extent, pretty much the way I feel. Although some of us don't have to do it to make a living, not one of us, I've noticed, unless it's for reasons of health, ever drops out. I hate work. I've always hated work, but there's one big work that I would never give up. I know that as long as I can speak and as long as I'm acceptable to the foundation and to the people who get the books, I'll go on recording as long as I can stand on my feet or get to the studio. I'm going to read two selections. The first from Robert Crichton's novel, The Secret of Santa Vittoria, and the second from Winston Churchill's History of the English-Speaking Peoples. Fabio woke in the early afternoon. He was still tired, but he woke because he was hungry. He looked around the small house, but there was nothing in it to eat, not a piece of stale bread or hard cheese. He was sorry he'd eaten all the cold beans. He left a note for Ernesto. Ants would starve to death in your house if ants would come into it. And he went out into the Corso Mussolini and started up it toward the Piazza of the People to try to buy some bread and cheese and wine. The midday sun blinded him, and he was forced to hold on to the walls of the houses until his eyes could adjust to the glare. When he reached the piazza, he was conscious of groups of people standing about in it, looking back down toward Old Town, but he was too blinded to see what it was they were looking at. The Piazza of the People is the center of Santa Vittoria. It is a flat plateau of cobblestones that divides the city into two parts. Above the piazza is High Town, where the houses sit on a saddle of land in the sun. No one knows why the city wasn't built there in the first place. The people who live in High Town are called goats. The people who live around the piazza are called turtles because of the fountain. Below the piazza is Low Town or Old Town, where the frogs live, because in the spring, after a rain, little green frogs hop in the dank, moss-green streets until the rats and the cats and the children get to them. On a tourist map, although tourists don't come here, Old Town is listed as the medieval section, which makes it sound better. Frogs almost never marry turtles, and turtles don't speak to goats. That's the way they are here. The city is steep. The Corso Mussolini, which runs through Old Town up to the Piazza of the People, is so steep in places that the street becomes flights of stone stairs. The Corso runs down to the Fat Gate. which is the main passage through the fat wall, which the Romans began, and which someone else finished, and which runs all of the way around Santa Vittoria. There is another way out, the thin gate, but this is used mainly by small boys and goats, since the track that leads down the mountain from it is so steep. In the summer of the Roman year 699, now described as the year 55 before the birth of Christ, the proconsul of Gaul, Gaius Julius Caesar, turned his gaze upon Britain. In the midst of his wars in Germany and in Gaul, he became conscious of this heavy island which stirred his ambitions and already obstructed his designs. To Caesar, the island presented itself as an integral part of his task of subjugating the northern barbarians to the rule and system of Rome. The land not covered by forest or marsh was verdant and fertile. The climate, though far from genial, was equable and healthy. The natives, though uncouth, had a certain value as slaves for rougher work on the land, in mines, and even about the house. The Romans, however, hated and feared the sea. By a supreme effort of survival, they had 200 years before surpassed Carthage upon its own element in the Mediterranean. But the idea of Roman legions landing in the remote, unknown, fabulous island of the vast ocean of the north would create a novel thrill and topic in all ranks of Roman society. Thus, in this summer, 55 years before the birth of Christ, Caesar withdrew his army from Germany, broke down his massive and ingenious timber bridge across the Rhine above Koblenz, and throughout July marched westward by long strides towards the Gallic shore, somewhere about the modern Calais and Boulogne. In the early days, Britain was part of the continent, a wide plain joined England and Holland, in which the Thames and the Rhine met together and poured their waters northward. In some slight movement of the earth's surface, this plain sank a few hundred feet and admitted the ocean to the North Sea and the Baltic. Another tremor, important for our story, sundered the cliffs of Dover from those of Cape Grinet, and the scour of the ocean and its tides made the Straits of Dover and the English Channel. As an actor, Kermit Murdoch, our next reader, has been called upon to play roles as different from one another as the president of Yale and a comic cab driver, or as Clarence Darrow and John Dillinger. In real life, Mr. Murdoch would seem to fit most comfortably into the robes of learned counsel or a college president, an impression that is confirmed by his involvement in public affairs. He's been active in New York politics since 1938, and was at one time vice chairman of the Queens County Liberal Party and leader of his assembly district in Queens. Mr. Murdoch was born in Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania, just outside of Pittsburgh, but grew up in Brooklyn. It was during his senior year at Harvard that he decided on an acting career and applied to do graduate work at Yale with Professor George Pierce Baker. His appearances in the Yale dramatic productions marked the start of his career. Since then, he's worked steadily in radio, television, the theater, and films. Mr. Murdoch is another who's been with the Talking Book program for many years, and his resistance to being typecast, say rather his versatility, has stood him in good stead in recording the hundreds of books he has been assigned. Mr. Murdoch reads first from the 19th century English mystery story, The Moonstone, by Wilkie Collins, and then from The Firmament of Time by Lauren Isley.
I address these lines, written in India, to my relatives in England. My object is to explain the motive which has induced me to refuse the right hand of friendship to my cousin John Herncastle. The reserve which I have hitherto maintained in this matter has been misinterpreted by members of my family, whose good opinion I cannot consent to forfeit. I request them to suspend their decision until they have read my narrative, and I declare on my word of honor that what I am now about to write is strictly and literally the truth. The private difference between my cousin and me took its rise in a great public event in which we were both concerned, the storming of Seringapatam under General Baird on the 4th of May, 1799. In order that the circumstances may be clearly understood, I must revert for a moment to the period before the assault and to the stories current in our camp of the treasure in jewels and gold stored up in the palace of Seringapatam. One of the wildest of these stories related to a yellow diamond, a famous gem in the native annals of India. The earliest known traditions describe the stone as having been set in the forehead of the four-handed Indian god who typifies the moon. Partly from its peculiar color, partly from a superstition which represented it as partaking of the nature of the deity whom it adorned, and growing and lessening in luster with the waxing and waning of the moon, it first gained the name by which it continues to be known in India to this day, the name of the Moonstone. Man is at heart a romantic. He believes in thunder, the destruction of worlds, the voice out of the whirlwind. Perhaps the fact that he himself is now in possession of powers wrenched from the atom's heart has enhanced the appeal of violence in natural events. The human generations are short-lived. We have difficulty in visualizing the age-long processes involved in the upheaval of mountain systems, the advance of continental glaciations, or the creation of life. In fact, scarcely 200 years have passed since a few wary pioneers began to suspect that the Earth might be older than the 4,004 years B.C. assigned to it by the theologians. At all events, the sale of Velikovsky's Worlds in Collision a few years ago was a formidable indication that after the passage of two centuries of scientific endeavor, man in the mass was still enormously susceptible to the appeal of cataclysmic events, however badly sustained from the scientific point of view. It introduced to our modern generation, bored long since with the endless small accretions of scientific truth, the violence and catastrophism in world events which had so impressed our forefathers. Man has always had two ways of looking at nature, and these two divergent approaches to the world can be observed among modern primitive peoples, as well as being belief in seen and unseen nature. He is both pragmatist and mystic. He has been so from the beginning, and it may be that the quality of his inquiring and perceptive intellect will cause him to remain so till the end. Primitive man, grossly superstitious though he may be, is also scientist and technologist. He makes tools based upon his empirical observation of the simple forces around him. Man would have vanished long ago if he had been content to exist in the wilderness of his own dreams. Instead, he compromised. He accepted a world of reality, a natural, everyday, observable world in which he existed and whose forces he utilized in order to survive.
Terry Hayes Sales is a Chicagoan by birth, but now lives in Louisville, Kentucky with her husband. Mrs. Sales began her professional career at the age of 15 as a singer on a radio station in Chicago. By the time she finished high school, her future in radio was assured. Mrs. Sales chose college instead. Later on, marriage and motherhood allowed her only a part-time career in radio and television and on the stage. The quality of Mrs. Sales' reading voice has often been commented on favorably. She explains this as an effort on her part not to come between the book and the reader. She says, "When I do a book, it is as though I'm not there at all. When you read a book to yourself, you hear the characters speaking. You don't say to yourself, 'This is how I would say such and such.' They are saying it." Now Miss Sales reads from Gwen Bristow's novel, The Handsome Road.
There was the day Colonel Cheremy came to dinner, and he and Dennis got into an argument in the library afterwards. Corey May had been sent down to ask the housekeeper, Mrs. Maitland, for some summer curtains that needed to have the lace repaired where it had been torn in the laundering. She could hear Dennis and Colonel Cheremy arguing as she passed the library door. Colonel Cheremy was saying vehemently, "You're entirely wrong, Dennis. The fomenters of rebellion in South Carolina are menaces to our welfare as well as their own. Dividing the Union would be..." "But how," Dennis interrupted, "can you overlook the injustices the South had been enduring these 20 years? Encroachments by Congress?" "What encroachments, you young hothead? It was Southern sentiment that nullified the 1850 compromises. It was Southerners on the Supreme Court." Their voices got fainter as Corey May went down the hall to the sewing room. But as she sat working on the lace, she could still hear them talking, and though she could not make out the words, she could tell they were getting mad with each other. Finally, Colonel Cheremy went angrily out to his horse. As Dennis came out of the library, Anne met him in the hall. She had evidently been waiting. "So that's how you talk to my father," she exclaimed. The two of them stood in the hall just outside the sewing room. "That's how I'll talk to anybody who calls me a misinformed young fool," Dennis retorted. "Your father sounds like an abolitionist congressman."
"He's not an abolitionist, and that's got nothing to do with it anyway. If you can't remember the respect you owe him..."
"Since you don't know anything about politics, you'd better not try to give opinions."
Dennis was evidently getting mad with her, too.
"I'm not talking about politics," Anne flashed back. "I'm talking about manners. You're as uncouth as an overseer. I want you to go right after him and apologize for what you said."
"I'm not sorry for a word I said, and I'll do nothing of the sort. It's time somebody told him a few facts."
"Yes, you will apologize."
"I most certainly will not. Be quiet."
"You insult my father, and you tell me to be quiet? You won't apologize to him?"
"Certainly not."
"You insufferable boor."
Corey May heard footsteps and the rattle of starched petticoats as Anne ran upstairs.
Guy Sorel's interest in spoken language, he's bilingual in French and English, and can pronounce German, Italian, and Spanish like a native, and his record collection of more than 2,500 discs, make it particularly fitting that he should have become a recording artist for the Talking Book program. Mr. Sorel was born in France and spent his early years in this country in Philadelphia and New York. His first appearance on Broadway was as the 78-year-old French Prime Minister Georges Clemenceau in a historical play about the Versailles Treaty. The part offered scope for his particular talents and defined the role he was afterwards to excel in, that of character actor. Mr. Sorel has worked in radio, television, and films. He's married to Mary Jane Higby, who also records for the program, and whose voice is familiar to thousands through her appearances on daytime radio serials. Here's Mr. Sorel reading from the story The Apple of His Eye by Gerard Robichaud. Then from Young People in Central Europe, a nonfiction book for young people by Charles R. Joy.
Michel Dumont knelt on the prie-dieu inside the dark confessional booth of St. Vincent's Church in Groveton Falls, Maine. As he waited his turn, his heart jumped. He wet his lips. Thursday afternoon, 3 to 4, was the hour for the children's confession, as was Saturday morning. But he could not wait for Saturday. If the world were going to end that soon, there might never again be any more Saturdays. Now his lips had really dried up, and his heart pounded. He switched from one knee to the other and back again and waited. He was out of breath, as if he'd skated with a hockey puck all the way at top speed toward the goalpost. Now or never. No postponement. The time had come. Anyway, inside the confessional booth, there could be no backing out. After you entered and knelt, soon the priest opened the little grill door and, miséricorde, you began to confess. Michel wet his lips and closed his eyes. The thing to do? First to confess the big sin, and then all the little sins would jump out of his mouth like sheep over the fence. Mon père, I accuse myself of sneering at ma tante Francine, of tripping Céleste Dumont so she would fall and show her bloomers. No, no, little sins all these were. First thing to do right away, to confess the big sin. Outside the church, Titur Morin, his best friend, waited for Michel to tell him what Father Prévost would decide about the big sin, which was like the dream Titur had had once. He had swallowed a frog, a live frog. Inside his stomach, in his dream, Titur could hear the frog grunt. All the time now, Titur was hungry. The more he ate, the fatter became the frog. For each time Titur ate, so did the frog. This sin was like a frog in his soul, and each day that went by, each minute, this sin got fatter and fatter. There would be no peace until he spat it out. If Europe is a continent, it is the second smallest of all the continents, 4,129,908 square miles. Yet it has more people than any other continent except Asia. And there are more people per square mile living there than in Asia. There are 560 million of them, which means over 150 per square mile. Europe is very thickly settled. The United States, including our most recent states, Alaska and Hawaii, has only a little more than 50 people per square mile, or about one-third the population density of Europe. Europe is far too small for the 30 nations that live in it. It often seems like 30 families of many different backgrounds in a slum block fighting each other, mostly because they're so crowded together. But is Europe really a separate continent? The geographers say no. It is only the large western peninsula of Asia, or, if you prefer, of Eurasia, as this huge landmass is sometimes called. On the south, it is bordered by the Mediterranean, the Black Sea, and the Caucasus. On the east, by Asiatic Russia. On the north, by the Arctic Ocean. And on the west, by the Atlantic Ocean. There are a number of other peninsulas that jut out from the European Peninsula. There is the great Scandinavian Peninsula in the north, the Iberian Peninsula in the southwest, the Italian Peninsula in the south, and the Balkan Peninsula in the southeast. The Peloponnesus in the south of Greece is still another peninsula, and it is really a peninsula of the Greek Peninsula, which is a peninsula of the Balkan Peninsula, which is a peninsula of the European Peninsula, which is a peninsula of the Eurasian continent.
Robert Donnelly tells a story about himself at age 3 when he produced, directed, and acted in a pantomime skit of his own devising, Milking an Imaginary Cow. Since then, Mr. Donnelly's acting career has spanned radio, both acting and announcing, television, Broadway and off-Broadway, and he has on more than one occasion, in college and in stock companies, repeated his boyhood tour de force. In fact, it is still his most earnest wish to own with his wife Toni a year-round professional theater where they will be able to produce, direct, and act in the plays they choose. Mr. Donnelly is a descendant of the earliest settlers of Greene County, Pennsylvania. He was born on a farm near Carmichael's and went to school in a one-room schoolhouse. The first hint that he had any acting talent came in his first semester at Waynesburg College, when he was unexpectedly drafted to play the lead in the senior play. Realizing then that people got paid for something that seemed second nature to him, he resolved to turn professional. Mr. Donnelly began recording talking books in 1946. Of the many recordings he has made, he says, "Recording a book is telling a story, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, and to me, telling a story is the very basis of acting." Mr. Donnelly's first selection is from a science fiction story by Alan Norse called Brightside Crossing. His second is from the article The Adaptive Ibis, appearing in Natural History magazine for August-September 1967.
James Barron was not pleased to hear that he had had a visitor when he reached the Red Lion that evening. He had no stomach for mysteries, vast or trifling, and there were pressing things to think about at this time. Yet the doorman had flagged him as he came in from the street. "A thousand pardons, Mr. Barron. The gentleman," he would leave no name, "he said you'd want to see him. He'll be back by 8. Barron drummed his fingers on the tabletop, staring about the quiet lounge. Street trade was discouraged at the Red Lion, gently but persuasively. The patrons were few in number. Across to the right was a group that Barron knew vaguely. Andean climbers, at least two of them were. Over near the door he recognized old Balmer, who had mapped the first passage to the core of Vulcan Crater on Venus. Barron returned his smile with a nod. Then he settled back and waited impatiently for the intruder, who demanded his time without justifying it. Presently, a small, grizzled man crossed the room and sat down at Barron's table. He was short and wiry. His face held no key to his age. He might have been 30 or 1,000, but he looked weary and immensely ugly. His cheeks and forehead were twisted and brown with scars that were still healing. The stranger said, "I'm glad you waited. I've heard you're planning to attempt the bright side." Barron stared at the man for a moment. "I see you can read telecasts," he said coldly. "The news was correct. We are going to make a bright side crossing." "At Perigin?" "Of course. When else?" The grizzled man searched Barron's face for a moment without expression. Then he said slowly, "No, I'm afraid you're not going to make the crossing." "Say, who are you, if you don't mind?" Barron demanded. The name is Clayney, said the stranger. There was a silence. Then, Clayney? Peter Clayney? That's right. Baron's eyes were wide with excitement, all trace of anger. My God, man, where have you been hiding? We've been trying to contact you for months. I know. I was hoping you'd quit looking and chuck the whole idea. Quit looking? Baron bent forward over the table. My friend, we'd given up hope, but we've never quit looking. Here, have a drink. There's so much you can tell us. His fingers were trembling. Peter Kenny shook his head. I can't tell you anything you want to hear. But you've got to. You're the only man on Earth who's attempted a bright side crossing and lived through it. And the story you cleared for the news, it was nothing. We need details. In 1961, it was discovered that the glossy ibis, Phlegetis falconellus, was nesting within the boundaries of New York City, just southwest of Kennedy International Airport. This species, which until recently had only been found breeding in a relatively remote area in southern Florida, quite suddenly took up residence in the shadow of one of the busiest jet ports in the United States. The New York City nesting ground is now the northern limit of the bird's breeding range in this country and marks the culmination of a dramatic range expansion by this species, which took place between 1955 and 1961. Several times during the late 1940s and early 1950s, conservationists had been concerned when severe drought conditions in Florida forced many of the glossy ibis near Lake Okeechobee to desert the area. Their fears were apparently well-founded, because this was the only known breeding ground of these birds in the United States. Furthermore, it was generally agreed that the species was non-migratory in the Western Hemisphere, and it was believed that the drying of the Okeechobee marshes might seriously reduce the breeding population. The glossy ibis, however, exhibiting an unexpected adaptability, seemed to solve its own problem. One nest was reported in North Carolina in 1940, and another in 1947, indicating that certain individuals had been able to nest away from the concentration at Lake Okeechobee. Then, between 1955 and 1961, the species' capability of pioneering in new areas was clearly indicated, as breeding pairs were reported in heronries at several localities scattered along the east coast north of Florida. Birds nesting north of the Carolinas tended to migrate south in the winter, while those nesting in the Carolinas and Florida were apparently permanent residents. Following these initial reports, the glossy ibis continued to acquire new breeding sites, and the numbers of nesting birds observed in each of these areas increased rapidly. The sharp increase in nesting ibis in the New York City area is typical of the rapid expansion of the species in all of its coastal nesting sites. In 1961, three nests were found in the Jamaica Bay Refuge. Two of these were in a heronry, and the third in a nearby marsh. The site was not checked again until the spring of 1965, when 20 pairs were spotted in the refuge, and 13 pairs were reported a short distance away.
Alan Haynes was born in Cardiff, Wales, and his introduction to the Talking Book program in 1960 was the happy outcome of a search for a competent reader who could pronounce the Welsh place names in a novel about Wales. Mr. Haynes's performance went far beyond mere competence. He showed himself master of the peculiarities of a geographical region and a literary form, but not bound by them. Undoubtedly, this is because of his strictly professional approach to the material he is assigned to read. The copy of the book he is reading from abounds in marginal notations, underscorings, and emphatic punctuation marks, all inscribed by Alan Haynes in order to convey the author's meaning to you as accurately as he can. Mr. Haynes reads first from a story about Scotland for young people, The Rough Road by Margaret McPherson, then from Holiday Magazine for July 1967, part of an article on New Caledonia.
It was the 1930s, when times were bad and shabby children were a common sight. In towns, men hung around street corners, workless. They stood in lines to draw the dole, money handed out by the government to keep them and their families from starvation. Sailors hung around the docks hoping to find a ship that wanted men, but more and more ships were being laid up. Shipyard workers stood by the yard gates, but the great cranes stood idle. Factory after factory closed down, for no one had money to buy their goods. Shopkeepers went bankrupt. Housewives fed their families on bread, margarine, and tea. In the country, farmers had to sell their cattle, sheep, and wool dirt cheap. Some gave up, sold what they had, and left the country. Others hung on, waiting for better times, piling up debts even while buying as little as possible. None of this bothered the boys in the very least as they followed the red, brown, and yellow bullocks to join the others. They stood to leeward of the men, and so were sheltered from the worst of the wind and rain. "Oh, gosh, Tom, I'm hungry," said Jim. He was, in fact, almost always hungry, for his foster mother judged his appetite by her own and seldom gave him enough to eat. "Got sandwiches," Tom announced, struggling to pull a packet out of his coat pocket. "Don't know how Mother managed to get them in. I can't get them out." But at that moment out they came, and Tom divided them with his friend. The thick oven scones spread with salt, butter, and cheese tasted wonderful and were finished all too quickly. Jim's sharp eyes were on the crofters, heads together, talking away 10 to the dozen. "Terrible weather for September," Jim mimicked into Tom's ear. Tom nodded, grinning. "Well, go on. It's your turn now." Tom reflected. "Aye, man, terrible. I don't remember the like. Have you cut your corn?" Jim giggled, then straightening his face with an effort, replied dolefully, "Och, aye, I've cut it, and man, I should have left it the way it was. It's sprouting in the stook, and the crows are black on it in the morning." Tom ran out of invention. "You do it," he said. "I can't copy them the way you do." Thus encouraged, Jim gave a very fair imitation of an old man quavering. "Aye, Tom, man, we'll need to sell every hoof we have, for there'll be no harvest this year by the looks of it." As every Frenchwoman knows, the stores called Prix Unique supply most of every Frenchman's needs. Soccer balls, net shopping bags, work clothes dyed that particular cerulean blue, Gauloises by the carton, Evian by the bottle, cheese by the loaf, and enough mackerel pickled in white wine to pique the appetite of all Gaul. The branch of Prix Unique in Nouméa, a city 12,282 miles by air from Paris, carries such necessities of French life as pâté of wild boar, quenelle de volaille, andouille de vire, the oily sausages of Normandy, and prepared cassoulet, the beany stew of Toulouse. New Caledonians didn't always eat so well. Indeed, when a French survey party put ashore in 1850, the New Caledonians ate the French. 2 years or so that the French have ruled New Caledonia, they have established order and laws, including one that has taken boiled French sailor off the menus. While their politics may not always be endearing, the French do have a talent for a style of life that is attractive and inviting. And when jets shortened the vast distances that separate Nouméa from almost any other place, New Caledonia suddenly surfaced as an attractive and very French island. In the last few years, hotels have been built and beaches have been raked, and there's a hint of a new coral sea riviera on the Route de la Corniche, which runs along the Baie des Citrons and Anse Varta, neighboring sandy coves. The government budget for tourism is up nearly 100% since last year. Airlines offer service from Paris, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Australia, and New Zealand. Last February, Pan American World Airways Board of Directors explored the island, and by spring, representatives from Intercontinental Hotels, a Pan American subsidiary, were in Nouméa negotiating for the handsome Chateau Royal Hotel, which opened last summer. If this is the dawn of a Pacific era, which President Johnson heralded in a speech last year, and which Teddy Roosevelt had predicted in 1903, and which Captain Cook knew all along, then Nouméa is sure to become a favorite of island hoppers. After Samoa and Fiji, New Caledonia is the last of the 3 equidistant stepping stones marking the southwesterly route from Hawaii to Australia. Unlike American Samoa, British Fiji, or French Tahiti to the east, New Caledonia is no drowsy Pacific island, nor even a gentle island. Some of its mountains are a mile high, and its weather can be as cool as spring in Cleveland. On the east coast, the mountains rise abruptly behind black beaches sprinkled with pulverized bits of chromium and iron. 250 miles long and barely 28 miles wide, it is ringed by living coral reefs that enclose a huge lagoon, a favorite of skin divers and shell collectors alike. In fact, so many troca shells come from New Caledonian waters that they are exported to France for the manufacture of mother-of-pearl.
What you have heard is only a sampling of the books and magazines that have been recorded, and only a few of the voices you will be hearing. As far as possible, we try to suit the voice to the subject matter. Hence, the more varied your reading, the wider will be your acquaintances with our readers. Let us know your favorites, so that we may be able to direct you to other books by the same readers. Let us have your opinion, too, of the books themselves. By doing so, you will help to guide us in choosing books for the program. In fact, it's here to be produced in recorded form that we might very well begin a survey of the Talking Book program. From a number of sources, advance notices in publishers' trade press, readers' recommendations, book reviews, book rating lists, advisory committees, a particular book presents itself as a likely candidate for a talking book. The book is examined at the Library of Congress. Its content is summarized, and the decision to produce it on records is made. From then on, to the time when the talking books are about to be sent to the regional libraries, the book is in the hands of a non-profit agency that specializes in recordings. When the talking books arrive at the regional libraries, they're ready to be circulated, and an announcement to this effect appears in the bi-monthly magazine Talking Book Topics. From your point of view, the most important parts of this operation are undoubtedly the regional libraries and the magazine Talking Book Topics. In other words, the answers to the questions, how do I know what books are available, and where do I get them? First, then, the magazine Talking Book Topics. Your subscription to it began the day you became a Talking Book reader, and you will continue to receive it every other month, free of charge, for as long as you remain a Talking Book reader. In it, you will find an annotated listing of new releases and an order form to send to your regional library requesting the books you want. You will also receive catalogs of past releases over 2-year intervals to tell you what the regional library has in stock. As for the regional libraries, they stand ready to help you in many other ways besides filling your orders for books, and will welcome any comments or questions you may have as a further opportunity to serve you. Your assignment to one of them at the outset was based on geographical locality, but no matter where you go, inside the country or outside it, you will always have a regional library at your command. If you're moving to a new address, give advance notice of this to your regional library so that they may arrange to have services resumed as soon as you're settled. The program of recording books for the blind began in 1934 with a federal appropriation. Shortly afterwards, more money was appropriated to supply phonographs, talking book machines, free of charge to readers of talking books. The phonograph before you now is the outcome of 30-odd years of experimentation and plain hard knocks. What it lacks in sophistication, it more than makes up for in dependability. The instruction sheet that came with the machine explains the use of such special features as the record stops, tone arm rest, and reset button, and lays down a few simple precautions to observe before playing a record. I will describe only two of these features, the tone arm rest and the record stops, because you'll begin using them with the first talking book records you play. The record stops are the two upright pieces of metal located to the right and left of the turntable at the back of the machine. They serve to position a record so that the hole in its center is directly above the turntable spindle and are adjustable to 10 and 12 inch records. Push them away from the turntable for 12 inch records, pull them in for 10 inch records. As for the tone arm rest, this also is adjustable to 10 and 12 inch records. Note that the left side slants towards the turntable. This is to guide the tone arm down to the pickup groove on the record. The records, too, have changed a good deal since the early days of the program. In their physical details and the manner in which they're produced, they've kept pace with advances in the recording industry. But of this, all that need be said here is that the records are of vinyl plastic and should therefore be handled carefully, and that they are 10 and 12 inches in diameter and play at 16 and 2/3 or 8 and 1/3 revolutions per minute. The recording speed will be indicated on the record label. It may happen that you will receive at some time in the future a talking book in which one of the records is damaged or missing. In that case, tie a string around one of the straps on the outside of the container, and return the talking book to your regional library. The librarian will check the defective talking book and see to it that you get a new copy. Don't enclose messages in the container. This would be a violation of postal regulations. Always use a regularly stamped envelope when you wish to write to your regional librarian. I shall close with a few pointers on how to judge whether your phonograph needs repair. First, always be sure that the records and needles are clean, that the phonograph is plugged in to an AC outlet and the correct switches are on, and that nothing is obstructing the turntable. Then place several records from different containers. If all the records sound the same, that is, if they all play too quickly, too slowly, or erratically, or if there is a constant humming noise in the background, then the phonograph needs repair and should be returned to the machine lending agency that sent it to you. It is from this agency also that you may obtain a new needle. And since worn needles are a frequent cause of faulty playback, worth trying a new one in the cartridge before returning the phonograph. That's all for now. May you have many, many hours of reading pleasure.